You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention, we have a bit of a family reunion going on here up in the front, but bring it to close. Thank you all for coming. It's a great pleasure to welcome you here. It's a great pleasure to welcome our speaker, Dr. Shirley Lin. Happy Moon Festival to all of you. This seems like a good time to be sitting outside at night, contemplating the full moon, drinking whatever you want to drink, and eating mooncakes, so enjoy. The title of our program today, Taiwan's China Dilemma, is the first part of the title of our author's new book, published by Stanford Press. Shirley Lin, besides being a dear friend, is a member of the faculty of the master's program in global political economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. She also teaches political science at the University of Virginia. Speaking of UVA, it is my great pleasure to acknowledge the presence of Harry Harding, who was a senior fellow here at Brookings from 1983 to 1994. During that time, Harry made a major contribution to the work of this institution, and he has always made a major contribution to the American understanding of China, and he's still at it. Dr. Lin did not start out life as a scholar and teacher. She worked for a number of years for Goldman Sachs. And among other things, she led the principal investment area for Asia department. And for more about that part of her life, I suggest that you look at the book Alibaba, The House That Jack Ma Built. It's an interesting story. I'm not going to tell you what it is. You have to look it up for yourself. Today we're here to talk about Shirley's own book, Taiwan's China Dilemma, Contested Identities and Multiple Interests in Taiwan's Cross-Strait Economic Policy. It was published this year by Stanford Press, and it explores a puzzle in how we understand cross-strait relations and Taiwan's domestic politics and their interrelationship. Answering that puzzle is important for both analysts and policymakers. And it's the puzzle that Shirley is going to solve for us today. Shirley, welcome.
Thank you, Richard, for your generous remarks. And yes, I would love to help Duncan Clark, my dear friend's book sales. So do buy Alibaba. He's on the book tour, actually, this week, also in D.C. Well, today, let's turn away from the internet and talk about something that is, of course, now more important than ever before. My talk is really about rising local identity in opposition to globalization in Taiwan. In particular, I'd like to touch upon the thesis of my book to answer the question, why are people voting for Trump, for Duterte, for Brexit? Why is Hong Kong witnessing the rise of localism and radical ideologies, including pro-independence, that never had been on the table in Hong Kong for my 23 years of living there until recently? Why can't money buy hearts? Well, while Beijing regards Taiwan as Chinese, people in Taiwan are consolidating a separate local identity. And as Taiwan experiences, of course, the uneven socioeconomic consequences of globalization, Taiwanese are weighing the cost of deeper integration with China against the opportunities presented by China's large and growing economy. The emergence of this local identity and the debates over further integration are especially evident among young people. These trends pose serious challenges for Beijing, which wants to deepen Taiwan's political and economic integration with the mainland in order to secure Taiwan's unification. Several alternatives are available to China, but none is ideal, and all are highly problematic. So I'd like to explore all of these today in this short talk. I think first we all know China has overtaken Japan and the U.S. as the most important market for Taiwan. And as the economic power of China grows, actually the debate over identity in Taiwan has intensified. This is just a chart that shows you the export to China and import from China. With the overall trade number seemingly to have increased, what I want to note here that is not shown is that the trade surplus with China, however, has declined steadily in the last 3 years, especially after Taiwan and China enter into more agreements to liberalize economic relations. In 2015, trade surplus has declined to a 10-year low. It is now at a 2006 level. So while trade has increased, the benefits to Taiwan have been inconsistent. And this is also something that you're probably all well aware of. But in the last few years, this has also changed. Foreign direct investment from Taiwan to the world has steadily declined in favor of investing in China. China now, as of last year, is half of Taiwan's outward investment. Cumulatively, is about 60% of Taiwan's investment to the world. And this is what makes Taiwan and China quite different in terms of economic interdependence when you compare it to other countries, which depend on trade. Taiwan and China depend on investment, and this foreign direct investment is what drives trade. Taiwanese businesses move their plants to China. They develop long-term plans to hire local workers to transfer technology and move important sectors of Taiwan's economy to China or part of it in terms of the supply chain. And this is an integral part of why China has become a threat and an opportunity. Before I come to the discussion of identity, why is this important? I wanted to just insert this small story because Richard had properly introduced my former life, which at times I try to shy away from talking about. But I was on a business trip when I was when I had just become a newly minted partner at Goldman Sachs. And I remember very clearly, I was driving with a few colleagues to the Shanghai airport to look at our investment at that time in Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, an important to-be competitor to Taiwanese semiconductor companies. And that day in the newspaper on the front page was North Korea. And my American colleagues, who later actually came to work in Washington, D.C., and I won't talk about the name specifically, said to me, the Taiwanese people are as extreme as the North Koreans, because that day on the front page, there was Taiwan's economic policy towards China being restrictive in terms of semiconductor was on the same page as North Korean missile development. And I remember hearing the comments and thinking, it seems irrational to be restricting investments into China, but at the same time, what other country would want to invest all of their money in another country that is also an existential threat? So that kind of was the thesis, was the background to my researching this book. Initially, it was completely focused on actually economic data and politics of basically protectionism, politics of distributive uneven distributive consequences of economic liberalization. But over time, I came to more and more through over 300 interviews with business leaders and civil society and other opinion leaders. I came to realize that I was missing a big part of the puzzle. And even though I'm not a sociologist, I started spending a lot of time reading about identity. And this is what I found, of course, that the correlation was astounding, that much could not be just explained by uneven distribution in terms of economic gains. Here is the chart from 1992 to 2014. Of course, the update of it in 2015 and 16, actually, the latest data done by the Gentry University's most important election center study polls is the last 2 years have only cemented the conclusion that the trends are irreversible. You will see that initially in 1992, the discussion in Taiwan was really, are we Chinese or are we Taiwanese? And the percentage of people a little bit beyond this chart and beyond the ESC study, in 1989 in United Daily, there was a very important survey that showed 52% of Taiwanese said they were Chinese and only Chinese. Now, if you think about the context of the world, having just been to Israel and also the Baltic states, I would say that identity reversal is very rare in terms of how drastic it has been reflected in Taiwan. In 1992, it was already a quarter and 50%. A quarter said they were Taiwanese, a quarter said they were Chinese, and 50% said they were both Taiwanese and Chinese. Over the years, the debate has intensified. And at about 2004 and 5, it started to consolidate. This is while trade was increasing at a very, very high accelerated rate and investment as well. And I would say by 2008, basically 50% of Taiwanese said they were exclusively only Taiwanese. They were not both, and they were not Chinese. When given in a three-way survey. Of course, there are many, many surveys, and polls are crude in general, but most of the other polls that ask more detailed questions reflect the same trend. By 2016, August, just last month, the number of people who say they're Taiwanese for the last 3 years has been 60%. And so the trend is seems quite irreversible. More important than this is young people. The younger generation is, I think, much more important in the sense that under 30, basically, four to five different polls this year, you will find the trend is double among young people relative to the older generation. So this is alarming for Beijing, for the world. The second part of identity that's important is what do they think of their preferred national status, future national status, in terms of unification, independence. But I think those are topics that that polarize the discussion. What really people are choosing is between autonomy and being ruled by Beijing. If you were to put it that way, the surveys that usually ask six or seven different categories, meaning would you prefer unification now, later, indefinitely? Would you prefer independence now, later, or status quo now, later, indefinitely? These polls show basically, if I put them in two categories, one is preference for autonomy, which says status quo or independence, and the other category is unification for now or later. And if you look at that, I group them in a way that is not usually shown by the ESC polls in these two groups. The bottom line shows preference for unification. They want unification as soon as possible or eventually. And the top line shows preference for autonomy. And you can see that the divergence is very clear. And the last 2 years, the trend continues. So the rise of national identity and Taiwanese identity is something that is very recent in comparison to other countries. After democratization, of course, it was no longer a taboo to discuss identity. And Taiwanese identity, as I said before, was very polarized between Taiwanese and Chinese. And it became consolidated only in the last 15 years. Until democratization, Taiwanese identity's polarization was really on ethnic lines. Between Benshenren, those who were living in Taiwan before the KMT came to Taiwan and in 1949, and Waishenren, who came afterwards with the nationalist government. But as economic integration with China deepened and identity consolidated, this consolidation increasingly embodied what most of my interviewees in the book said, a way of life. And it embraces civic values such as democracy, rule of law, freedom of speech, press and assembly. And as Morris Chang, the CEO of TSMC, tells it to me, I think his definition is quite good. And that way of life is For young graduates who study double E, they wake up in the morning, and every day they can decide where they want to go, where they want to work, and simply how they want to make a living. And this way of life is something that was very important to especially the younger generation. Taiwanese identity, of course, also values more and more international recognition, environmental sustainability, and economic freedom and open markets. The younger the respondents are, the more likely they care about economic liberalization toward China. They want to reap the benefit of economic liberalization while at the same time be who they are, which is different. So this is under the premise of putting Taiwan first. And I think the value differential is also important between generations. In Taiwan, they have these open surveys, which they also do in Hong Kong now. They'll ask you on the street face-to-face polls where they say, what are important values to you? And young people write it down, or by generation, they'll divide these polls. The older generation usually would write down things like rule of law. The younger generation, likely in Hong Kong that last year, in that kind of an open poll, they said the most important value to them was democracy, which the older generation rarely pointed out. And in Taiwan, they said, the younger generation said they wanted a more just society. So these are interesting words that that mean a lot to a certain group. Now, in the book, what I try to do is I look at different policy reversal in Taiwan's policy towards China. And what's very interesting, of course, in 1996, 2001, 2006, and 2008, there were four different policy reversals. And now, of course, we have, if you will, 2016, another, I would say, 2014 to 16 is another episode reversal with a lot of opposition to the service trade agreement, as well as the new policy to have a new southbound investment policy. But going back to these four episodes, which are studied in the book, the four episodes really were very extreme at first. In 1996, when Lee Teng-hui started to implement the no haste and be patient policy, he started off by calling a conference, the National Development Conference. And this was to create a consensus among the domestic constituents to forbid investments over $20 to $50 million, depending on the net asset value of the company, into China. And this was something that was very, very detrimental to large companies. And one of his closest friends, of course, Y.C. Wang, was very much opposed to the policy and spent a lot of time working on reversing this policy. You will find that in this episode. People who actually say that they're Taiwanese in terms of the identity poll also very much supported No Haste. And then in the second episode, when Chen Shui-bian became president, he actually decided, in order to get close to the business community, he wanted to reverse the policy and open up completely in order to revive the Taiwanese economy. Now, this sounds quite familiar if you were to fast forward 20 years later. But if you look at in 2001, he also called a conference called the EDAC and tried to open up the reverse the policy that Lee Teng-hui had and open up, for example, semiconductor investments into China. This created a led to a very big protest on the streets of Taiwan and in different cities, and in particular, citizens who didn't really even understand what TSMC and UMC actually do went on the street because they thought jobs were being lost, the Taiwanese economy was being hollowed out. And again, the correlation between those who thought they were Taiwanese and those who were against the reversal of policy was very closely tied together. Now, by 2006, at this point, Chen Shui-bian was under a serious personal corruption scandal, and he wanted to reverse the policy that he earlier had implemented. And by the way, I just want to point out, in 2001, active opening effective management was when Tsai Ing-wen was working at the Mainland Affairs Council. So it's something that is very, very closely tied to the current administration in terms of much of the thinking you will find in the study of the EDAC, where she chaired the Cross-Strait panel. In 2006, again, they called a conference CSTED, but this conference very few people remember because the end result was there was not a lot of policy change, but what they had done in my discussion with the Investment Commission was they tightened the regulation, they enforced it more stringently, strictly than ever before, and they took even measures such as sending people, Investment Commission sent people to the semiconductor companies to check out the machines that they were shipping. And even though most of the people who actually went to visit didn't really understand what each of the machines was meant to do, it was very important for public support to actually to show that they were stopping this migration. And in 2006, after only a brief period of this stringent regulation, of course, Ma Ying-jeou was elected in 2008, and he started a string of bilateral economic liberalization called the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement, otherwise known as PROSPER again in Hokkien. And the campaign for the ECFA was meant to revive the economy and bring back the jobs and benefit from the good intentions that Beijing had toward Taiwan. What followed, of course, was widespread protest against the ECFA, and all the follow-on agreements have also generated a lot of protests. But I would say in 2006 and 2008, the protest level and the discussion about the policy was much more rational, moderate. And in looking at primary material, the discussion about these two policy reversals was much less linked to identity. And it was no longer whether you were Taiwanese, so you support the policy, or you were pro-unification, so you were against certain kind of policy. In fact, in 2006 and 2008, Taiwan's discussion about economic policy started to have a very rational and moderate discussion that was focused on the economic benefits and about the winners and the losers of such economic liberalization. What I found, of course, through this is that national identity was the basis of economic preference. Oftentimes, if you look at people who study cross-strait economic relations, they'll say you either have to, what is often said colloquially, is go with your heart or with bread. So you have to choose money or your identity. But what I really found is that most people in the interviews would not tell you about identity. That's not something that comes to mind. But in the back of their mind, that is what everybody eventually, after 3 hours of interviewing, eventually comes to. And this is something that is really fascinating to me. So the evolution of Taiwan's national identity really was as important as the evolution of Taiwan's economic conditions in shaping cross-strait economic policy. Of course, without a sense of national identity, there can be no consistent economic policy. With the definition of national identity consolidated, then a community is able to identify and prioritize different national interests. This doesn't mean, of course, that it's easy to prioritize those different competing interests, whether it's security, equality, or equity, and stability. And now increasingly environmental sustainability, for example. There's limited resources and competing goals. In Taiwan, of course, we have extensive and intensive debate over policy options that finally lead to formulation of cross-strait economic policy. Now, each of these episodes, you will ask me, we are in D.C., of course, you'll say, what about the U.S.? What about Beijing? Those are very important factors, of course. And I would say, if you look at each of these episodes, there is a debate about identity that's in the background. And then there is the environment. In both the episode 2 and episode 4, I would say the U.S. economy was an important factor, very important factor. In 2001, there was an economic downturn, especially following the internet bubble bursting, and Taiwan's technology export dropped dramatically. And in 2008, after the global financial crisis, a lot of Taishan's business was seriously hurt. In 1995 and 1986, as well as 2005, of course, Beijing was an important factor. The missile crisis in 95 and 96 led to an overwhelming level of support for Lee Teng-hui's no-haste policy of restricting investment into China because the Taiwanese felt that their security was threatened. In 2005, Beijing instituted the anti-secession law and legislated that if Taiwan had any intention toward independence, that Beijing would have to take coercive measures. And this led to the biggest protest in Taiwan that united the blue and the green, pan-blue and the pan-green supporters. So the environment is very important. However, you have to look at it in the context of how the society views all of these factors. And interests keep shifting. So initially, there were fewer interests to be concerned about. In 1995, 1996, security was paramount. But over time, of course, the list of interests grows. And people care more and more about equity, about maintaining the middle-class society that Taiwan has. But continuing to grow and having a more stable society and a secure one. I divide the societies in terms of this debate into extensive restriction, moderate restriction, extensive liberalization, and moderate liberalization. And you have the policy that I discussed before. Now, this polarized identity has caused policy oscillation in Taiwan for the last few decades. The general observation I have here is that when identity is polarized, there's a perceived choice between extreme policies. You feel like you have to support No Haste or oppose it, that there is no middle ground. The same thing for the Act of Opening in 2001. Much of the business community was very much opposed to No Haste and wanted Taiwan to reverse its policy, while the public started to be mobilized. Even the teachers' union weren't on the street to oppose the semiconductor being open to investing in China. As identity consolidates, of course, extreme policy options slowly then become eliminated. People favor extreme policies less and less, and the nature of debate becomes more rational, as in the case of the ECFA. At the time the ECFA was signed in 2010 in Chongqing, actually there was an overwhelming support in Taiwan according to the polls. Up to the signing of the ECFA, there were polls on a weekly basis. People were tracking it very carefully, even though the debate was very intense. If you look at the discussion, there was very little discussion about whether one was Taiwanese or one was actually pro-unification in talking about the ECFA. It was about how many losers will there be, how many people will lose their jobs, and is Taiwan better off with the ECFA or not. But a consensus, as I said before, is still very hard to reach because it's difficult to prioritize competing interest. And the trade-off between growth and equity and security is still very difficult for most countries, let alone Taiwan, which is facing a tremendous threat from China. And of course, identity, as I said, receded into the background in these discussions about economic policy in 2006. But it can become salient again, as it has in the last 3 years. When the threat from China increases, the intense debate over the cross-strait service trade agreement that led to the Sunflower Movement is a good example. At this point, I want to shift gear a little bit because when I give this talk and I discuss the observations from my book, people always, depending on where I give the talk, there is always a question as to, well, what is happening in Beijing all this time? Well, what is happening in Beijing is also very interesting. And I'd like to remind the audience that Beijing has a bigger dilemma than Taiwan. As Taiwan's national identity consolidates, fewer and fewer Taiwanese want unification. Why is that important? Because even under the most favorable circumstances, Taiwanese, especially young people, say that they do not want unification. And so Beijing now faces fewer and fewer choices. And with its three choices, it really is trying to exercise three kinds of power: hard power, coercive power, sticky power, appealing with China's economic resources as a market, as investor, or the last one, soft power, policies that aiming to create a common Chinese identity. Of course, the first one is what I call sticky power, stay the course. Let's just keep doing what we've been doing all these years. Well, China's strategy so far has been using sticky power. The attraction of its material resources as a market or as an investor is undeniable. and this has been effective in achieving limited political accommodation. And it creates the interdependence that permits the use of coercive power. But of course, sticky power does not promote a common identity. So there seems to be a limit to what can be done. And more importantly, over the last 30 years, of course, the process has had the opposite result of creating a common identity rather than a positive political spillover on Taiwan. You will see that from 1993, I was just asking Richard, do you remember where you were? During the Kuang talk, I was actually in Singapore volunteering as a translator because there were not enough people there, except for those that went with the official delegate. And then followed by, of course, skip forward 2008, we have the Zhongcheng talk, and then the highlight, the Maxi meeting in 2005. So this is sort of, let's just keep doing what we've been doing. But military force, of course, is the ultimate form of hard power, and China threatens Taiwan regularly, but not just militarily. There are many ways to be coercive. Beijing has the ability to insert public and security forces into places like Hong Kong, but not in Taiwan. And therefore, its ability to use coercive power is more limited. It's more a demonstration of it. But there are other means that are very important. So here are the missiles aiming at Taiwan. And here is, of course, you will see PLA simulation exercise attacking Taiwan's presidential office. And this was shown on CCTV regularly. I was in between Beijing and Hong Kong during the election. And you see this on TV on a regular basis in January 2016. And then finally, we have other ways of being coercive. This is a teenage singer who a lot of Taiwanese will know very well in Korea, who was fired from her job or taken her contract was dissolved by agents who were pressured by mainland Chinese netizens who attacked her for waving a Taiwanese flag on the singing show that she was on. And this created, of course, more backlash among the Taiwanese voters. Denying markets, supplies, technology, or capital to investors, sector, or companies, or against the society as a whole. There's now a new term for this. It's called 穷台, is to make Taiwan poor. And it's the most recent example of this. The use of hard power is very alienating and likely to be counterproductive. So it's not often used. The next one is what is probably most effective but most difficult, is soft power. Narrow the gap. Let's show that there's a common ethnicity and language, setting aside the dialects. And essentially, this is requiring the narrowing the gap in values and institutions between China and Taiwan, to make political and societal integration more attractive. So here you have local elections. We have AIDS organizations in China to show that there's a vibrant civil society. So the question is, how far down the road would China have to go before that common identity began to revive? If it in 30 years Taiwanese become Taiwanese, surely in 30 years they can become Chinese again. How much democratization is needed? How much liberalization? How much federalization? And what is the likelihood that Beijing would be willing to do any of it? There's actually a fourth option, of course, which Beijing is now practicing, or you will, exercising in Hong Kong, and that is the mainlandization of Hong Kong through accelerated immigration, indirectly influencing perhaps Taiwanese media and business people, self-censorship among the media and businesses that are pro-China or have businesses in China. Well, in the last few minutes, I want to switch gear again. Then let's look at this in context. While my book is about how unique Taiwan is actually not very unique in certain ways, especially when I talked about the young people. From a global perspective, it's part and parcel of the worldwide trend, which also makes it very difficult for Taiwan to come out of it, since very few other countries have been able to escape what I call the high-income trap. So you can see from similar events around the world, here is the Hong Kong Umbrella Movement. Young people are protesting for democracy, for more participation. And here is Madrid at Puerta de Sol, where I lived for a year. This is the annual Labor Day protest, which has been growing. This is from the 2015 Labor Day. You'll see that, of course, youth unemployment in Madrid, in Spain, is about 49% at the time the picture was taken. It's double that of average adult unemployment, which is, of course, is astounding at 24%. Taiwan's number is roughly about 12% for young people and 6% for adults, so it's similar sort of percentage. And so this is, of course, angering young people in Taiwan. And next is Occupy Central, which I know so well because actually I was there quite often during Occupy Wall Street, and they also occupy HSBC in Hong Kong, and which I pass by nearly daily. And this is, of course, the protest against the power, growing power of financial institutions and against a growing inequality. So one other parallel is the rise of local identities is also very much part of what's going on around the world. This is me going on an identity tour. After I finished the book 2 years ago, I thought it'd be nice to finally go see all these cities that I've been writing about and thinking about. So I went on a tour to the Baltic states, as I said before, to Israel, also to visit the former Austronesian, Austro-Hungarian Empire, where there was, of course, a real identity debate. And I passed by the Budapest Market, where many of you probably have. When I gave this talk in Taipei, actually somebody in the audience jumped out and said, I was there. I know exactly what all of these flags are. It's really impressive, because I don't know how many of you know the flags, but even though I teach international political economy, I was not able to name most of the flags. And so you will see, actually, does anyone know what that flag is on the left? So I'm sure you know the book Dracula. This is a Transylvanian merchant, and he lives in Budapest, and his dream is, of course, to revive his nation. And I passed by, and I said, what is the Taiwan flag doing in this stall? So I waited for him for an hour. He was at lunch break. I waited there, and he couldn't wait to go to the back of his stall and get me a huge Taiwan flag. He says, this is for Facebook. I said, no. Facebook is not allowed for university professors, but, you know, let's take a picture, and I have the only copy here. But basically, these are all flags of European nations that would like to secede. Although I think the last one is actually a flag from from Quebec, yes. a Canadian told me that was a Quebec flag. But he insists that it was all European flags, and he was telling me about each and every one and the movement. I was very impressed for somebody who sells bags in the Budapest Central Market. So there's a rise of local identities around the world. The most well-known one, of course, is Brexit. We'll come to that in a minute. But what is happening in Taiwan, of course, is just part and parcel of this backlash against globalization. It may be a fact, but responding to it involves many, many choices, especially for young people. And even for small countries, domestic factors are very important, as we see more and more, and sometimes more important than external structure. Now, identity is intimately related to political preference, leading to extreme options, especially when it threatens your sense of identity, your sense of belonging. And the support for Brexit and for Trump in some ways is unexpected, but in other ways have long been coming. Now, problems arising from economic integration, of course, has had many negative consequences in high-income country. And that's what I am working on right now, because in many ways, the problems that Taiwan needs to resolve are difficult for many other countries. Inequality, stagnant wage level, especially for the middle class, the working class, and for young people. Government data usually just show in Taiwan, shows the top 20% and bottom 20% household income gap. But many studies have shown that the top 1% in Taiwan actually have gained steadily for 30 years relative to the rest of the 99% that barely grew. And that's only on tax receipt dollars. If you were to add capital gains on real estate, which now it's undervalued because the way tax is calculated for Taiwanese real estate gain is based on a government value that is very low. So the inequality could be even greater than we think. And Taiwan was, in 2011, the second highest in income concentration, trailing the U.S., Singapore, Britain, Japan, And this is, of course, exacerbated by women who don't want to have children and an aging population. I asked my students in Asia and in the U.S. About what kind of family they want. And consistently, female students don't want to have children or want to have only one. Very few have said two. I'm very surprised by it, even though I keep asking the question. Taiwan's fertility, of course, was the lowest in the world also in 2011, as it's been doing a little bit better in recent years. But it's right behind South Korea, Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and, of course, China, which is policy related. Now, with competitive monetary easing and fiscal stimulus in the U.S., Europe and Japan, assets have inflated, creating a housing level that is unaffordable for most young people. Taiwan has very, very few tools for this because really we're at the mercy of the Fed. In Taiwan, like elsewhere, as Joseph Stiglitz has written quite extensively, there's a rise of a separate identity among young people. And it reflects the generational injustice where, of course, older generations enjoy better job prospects, more secure retirement systems, more affordable housing. In the U.S., for example, there are more young people living at home than ever since World War II. But in Taiwan, something that is quite different than the world is young people and others blame all the problems on China. They increasingly believe that it is because of greater social and economic integration with China that we have these problems. They increasingly believe that China presents unevenly distributed economic opportunities and benefits, but presents severe challenges to identity and autonomy. The establishment, of course, is viewed as allowing businesses to benefit while ignoring inequality and social injustice, including food safety problems in Taiwan, where a returnee, if you will, Taishan business that came back from China was controlling a company that sold cooking oil that was tainted. And this is the facts aside, a lot of people blame this as importing immoral values from China to Taiwan. China's role, of course, is a conflicting one because its assertive political attitude internationally has led it to be to have mixed result with neighboring countries that want economic benefits from things like One Belt, One Road, from the AIIB initiatives, but at the same time are in military disputes with China. Now, there are two kinds, of course, of challenges facing that's facing the establishment. And they are qualitatively different. So first is economic woes like inequality and environmental damages, which I think long-term good public policy address those issues eventually. But the concerns also include fundamental value differences that are harder to bridge, like democracy, freedom, social justice. And this is why the students went on the street for the Sunflower Movement in 2014 to protest against the service trade agreement that young people perceive will replace jobs and basically destroy certain small medium businesses in Taiwan. Now, this rise of a new generation in Taiwan around the world, like I said, is a global trend. But what are young people doing about it? Well, they're dealing with it in very different ways. As I showed before, many of them are joining social movements. But in Taiwan, they're actually actively going into government. They have become quite successful. Actually, on the day I gave this talk in Tokyo Governor Koike was elected and as she was, like Taipei Mayor Koh, they were without party support. So one part of course, the big issue is the establishment is viewed in a hostile way by many of the voters. And creation of new parties there's no better example than last week's election in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong's elections are also very costly, very intensive, and there's a lot of intervention, if you will, by outside forces. It depends if you view Beijing as an outside force. But anyway, non-Hong Kong forces are very much involved. And these new parties, such as the New Power Party, won five seats in Taiwan in January 2019. 2016, I would say if you look at the investment they made into gaining these parliamentary seats, it was a very, very high impact, rewarding investment because the cost that there was very little resources compared to the existing parties that won those seats. And in Hong Kong, similarly, I have students who actually ran in the legislative election, legislative council election. So I know how costly those campaigns are and how intensive those are. But also, on September 4th, six legislative seats were gained by localists, not PEN Democrats, and who did not actually receive widespread support from the PEN Democrats in terms of the infrastructure. So I wanted to end by saying, what are the challenges facing the Thai administration? Now that we've discussed Taiwan's China dilemma in terms of the identity linkage to policy, and I've talked about Beijing's dilemma, and then there's the high income trap. Well, there's certainly a lot for the current administration to deal with. And I would say there are four areas of concern. First is Taiwan needs to increase its economic competitiveness. Taiwan needs to diversify its economic relations with the rest of the world, not only because of over-dependence, but the fact is China's growth, even at 6%, is a questionable country to rely on. And over-dependence obviously has already hurt a lot of companies in Taiwan, and this will continue to be the case unless Taiwan is able to find new sources of growth. Second is Taiwan has to reduce inequality, ameliorate the losses from economic liberalization. This includes retraining, helping industries like tourism that needs to move away from relying on Chinese tourists. But more importantly, Taiwan simply needs to upgrade its economy. It cannot continue to compete with China, Vietnam, India on manufacturing on a low-cost basis. It needs to encourage innovation in all the sectors. Why is it not happening? Fundamentally, long-term, is because education needs to be revamped. It needs to nurture entrepreneurship. This is something I speak quite a lot about, how to start a company, how to innovate, promote innovation, to have more skills that are actually connected to the market, and to believe in national service. There's, of course, a declining morale in the army, as all of you would know. Taiwan has a conscription system that is declining in morale and in many other measure. Finally, Taiwan needs to liberalize the financial sector. As some of you may know, one of its most important banks was fined by the U.S. Recently for anti-money laundering irregularities. And this is something that most people in the finance industry know for a long time. Taiwan is overregulated but under-enforced. So there's a lot of regulations that are seemingly perfect, but enforcement is selective, is ad hoc, and is not done very professionally. At the same time, Taiwan wants to internationalize many of its sectors, which will actually revolve around the financial sector. The second part, of course, of Thai administration's challenges is to manage cross-strait relations, to walk the tightrope, as they say. So to maintain the status quo without accepting the 92 consensus, to mitigate problems from over-reliance, as I said before, but how do you limit Chinese investments in semiconductor industry while still attracting more and more foreign capital? How to strengthen Taiwan's defense capability, and how to uphold, for example, Taiwan's territorial claim in the South China Sea while complying with international law? And the final two parts, of course, is for Thai administration, there needs to be domestic support and consensus, and this is very difficult. But ruthlessly prioritizing competing economic goals, building ties with young people, political parties, new parties, nurturing young leaders, and investing in public policy research and developing long-term strategy. And finally, to work on enhancing Taiwan's international status and garner support. We can talk more about this during the Q&A. TPP, APEC, of course, is something that is not as relevant today as in the past, and I personally am on a committee in Hong Kong representing the government to promote trade in Hong Kong. It's under APEC, but there's a lot of talk, of course, but not a lot of ability to actually use those organizations to really insert Taiwan's role. And to continue to negotiate TIFA and strengthen partnership for innovation and for security. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Shirley. That was a real tour de force. For those of us just coming back from summer vacation, it may be a challenge just to absorb. It raises a huge number of questions. I could sit here asking you questions until the sunset, but I won't, in deference to the audience. I just want to ask one, though, and it has to do with the strengthening of Taiwan identity to unprecedented levels. And you offered a couple of reasons, basically generational change and an attachment to certain values. But I wonder if there is not another one, and that is the contact that has developed between average Taiwan people and average mainland people over the last 30 years, and a growing sense on the island of Taiwan that we really are a different society. And actually, we're much more civilized than the other place.
Well, Richard, of course, I should mention, has written an excellent book about Hong Kong.
Thank you.
And I've read it only one-third of the way in. But I think Hong Kong is a great example of, to answer your question, because there is no society than Hong Kong that is in close contact with China. In fact, I think most Hong Kong people I know are first generation. So there's no cutoff like in Taiwan with 1949, and there's no separation. The border has always been very porous. But I think it's very clear from both the Taiwan and the Hong Kong experiences, the more interaction there is, the more separation there is in terms of the sense of identity. And I absolutely agree with it. And that's what I meant when I said the more a lot of young people blame the problems on more socioeconomic, actually integration, not less. And these problems, of course, consolidate their sense of being separate, having a separate identity. And I think this is something I didn't talk about as much, but one part of my new research focus is on young people and their sense of values. And of course, it's a very difficult research subject. You need a lot of polls. But I would say that the younger the respondents are in both Taiwan and Hong Kong, and the more they go to China, and this is also very interesting, the more they favor economic liberalization, but believe that they are a separate community. So this is a very interesting thing that's quite different. The older generation, when I talked about no haste, the support was overwhelming for Li Tenghui. But a lot of the respondents I talked to, they really care about Taiwan being separate from China, and they support a no haste. But they weren't quite in this time, you know, China must be part of my life. Whereas the younger people feel that China must be part of my life, but I want to go there when I want to go there, and I want to be home when I want to be home, and we are different people. And of course, for Hong Kong, it's really exacerbating to Beijing because the young people we're talking about, Hong Kong polls are divided. Some are under 29 years old, they call them young people. Some are under 35, depends on is it Hong Kong U, Chinese U, or Baptist University. And in either case, the younger the respondent is means the more education they received after the handover. So they were not educated by the Brits, but they firmly, after with increasing moral and national education, they actually believe they are less Chinese. And this is something, of course, very confounding, something very interesting, but I'll leave that for a different topic. But I agree with Richard.
So let's open it up. Please, once I've recognized you, wait for the microphone. Provide your name so Shirley knows to whom she's speaking. Ask one question, And one question alone, no MERV questions. And keep it short. You don't have to give a whole paragraph for Shirley to understand what you're trying to get at. So who has the first question? Tony Kane. Right in the middle, on the left. The mic a little bit closer, please.
I'd like to ask.
No.
Is it on?
It's okay.
On. Well, that's a problem.
This one on? Yeah, that
works. Better.
Okay, I want to ask about the relationship between Taiwan identity and globalization, because it kind of surprised me at the beginning that you linked the anti-globalization movements to Taiwan identity, but at least on your slide 19, you brought it back to kind of being more about China. And when I was in Taiwan with a group of students this summer, and we were all shocked at how globalized Taiwan was. Very different from the 70s and 80s when I was there. So it seemed to me that Taiwan is increasingly globalized, not anti. These young people are very much see that globalized identity as kind of a protection from Chinese identity.
Thank you for that question. I'm glad you raised it, because what I was trying to say is really Taiwanese are not anti-globalization, but they're anti-China. And this is what is very astounding, that most of the problems are really like inequality and wage stagnation are problems that all high-income countries are experiencing. But some of them can blame it on China, others cannot. But in Taiwan, they're co-mingled and often blame on Taiwan on China. And especially what I did for the last chapter of my book is, of course, the book came out sort of a year after it was supposed to, because my editor retired, and he was the head of Stanford Press. And because of that, things are just very lucky. While that was happening, the Sunflower Movement broke out. So I said, oh, well, I'm just going to make the book a little longer. And I went out to interview a lot of the student leaders. I excerpted two of them who I thought were fascinating. What I didn't write in the book was actually both of them said to me they were anti-capitalism. I said, really? What do you propose we do in Taiwan without capitalism? What's the new system that you propose? Well, they were fascinating, and they all want to get PhDs in economics. And I kind of told them, in economics, you wouldn't be studying capitalism. But I think it's like the Hong Kong student leaders. Eventually, they will resolve it. But the young ones, a lot of them are confusing globalization with what's happening vis-a-vis China. And I think that is the one difference. There's a lot of, you could see easily when I went to Israel, it was right after they actually spent 2 months on the street, students, protesting sort of rising unaffordability of housing. And I remember thinking, well, this is similar to other protests in Taiwan, but in Taiwan, it's very easy to become mixed up, if you will. So the student leaders told me, actually, at first when they started the Sunflower Movement, it was very much just opposing the STA, the Service Trade Agreement. But after the first few days, they found out what most people really cared about. So they changed their line. And I said, this is really fascinating. You could just do that? They said, well, it's okay. We will allow people to think we are protesting on their behalf. So we want to have the catch-all, sort of protest. And so they made it much more appealing to the public, and they changed their discussion to be much more focused on, jobs being lost, and small medium businesses like beauty parlors and printers losing their business to giant state-owned enterprises from China. So that's a very good point. I think the discussion as to what problems are from economic liberalization with the world, with China, and internal sort of domestic policy that are failing to retrain workers and create jobs. Those are different problems, and I think we have similar issues in the United States where you commingle the causes.
Mike Fonte. And
Mike Fonte, I'm the director of the DPP mission here. Thanks, Shirley, for a great presentation. Wonder what your thoughts are about the southbound policy that Tsai Ing-wen is trying to implement. Because it seems to me, I agree with you, there's some anti-globalization, but it's really a question of anti-China, because it's too linked to certain strata in Taiwanese society, the KMT at some level, whereas what Tsai is trying to do is develop more southbound trade. But all, in addition to the southbound policy, these centers of excellence, these five major projects, where do you think that's going, or is that possible for that to develop?
I agree with most of the policies that are being rolled out now. And I think that it's all in the details. And I think this is, I think that the headlines are in the right direction. But of course, partly, if you will, the voters voted the DPP in a landslide precisely because the over-reliance on China was not getting enough attention. And as any economic policy would have to, should have known for 10 years now that China is going to experience a slowdown. China's issue in terms of oversupply, over-leverage, and inability to move from an export economy to a domestic consumption economy, these are and demographic changes. These are problems that have long been coming. And so I think the KMT's neglect, and I may not have focused on it, but the younger generation is extremely focused on KMT's failure. And that's why they were, I also was there doing interviews on the day that Taipei mayor was voted in. And I went to several classes at Zhengda and Taida, and the students were uniformly voting for him. And they were angry about these policies vis-a-vis China, but other also policies that are domestically oriented. And I think that the perception, of course, is a collusion, of course. The fact that the government is helping businesses, and those businesses are doing things in China. And so this is all kind of linked to the elites not understanding what is going on at the middle-income households and for students. But coming back to the policy specific, I think it's very good that there is a new southbound policy. But if you will, if you remember, Li Tenghui is no haste. It didn't really work. After a while, what happened? 1997, there was a financial crisis. So while companies were going to Indonesia, this was happening as he was rolling out no haste. People started going, and then they realized there's nowhere to go because there's a financial crisis. Why are we going to countries that are going bankrupt? And I was writing that chapter just being reminded of what's happening now. I think it's very important to have the right policy, but at the same time, promoting trade and investment into India, into Vietnam, these are great initiatives. But I think the most important thing is the market has to lead. And I think that the government, this is a different era than the 70s or even the 80s, where you can have an industrial policy and develop certain strategies. And I think that's the next part that is worrisome, of course. The most important way to move away from over-reliance on China is to further relations with the U.S., Europe, and Japan. Because the numbers for Southeast Asia is too small. It won't make a dent. And I think it's very good that we're helping Taishan move their plans from Dongguan to Bangladesh or to Vietnam. I see it when I go. I sit on several company boards. I know it's important, but they're not going to make the numbers work. And so over-reliance on China, which is now only about 22% in terms of import-export, it can be balanced if we continue to trade and invest further with advanced countries that have innovation. And this is the other issue that's linked. Going to Southeast Asia is not going to help us upgrade Taiwan's economy. And we need to go where those are. And the second part I want to come to is the Silicon Valley, the big Taoyuan Asia Silicon Valley plan. And I think this is what you were talking to. It's great to promote innovation, but again, giving a lot of money to force startups to go public is simply sort of a reversal of what should be done, and it should be market-led. And I think innovation is something that needs to be done. For semiconductor, for example, it's important to have R&D relationships with advanced countries, and I think those governments can do. But there are other sort of, in terms of startups, to have governments, create a Facebook is something that is, the dynamic is very different than I think what Taiwan has capacity and knowledge of in the past. So this requires a different way of thinking. And I think that, doing a innovation park, a science park in a specific location is not the most, 4.0 way of doing it.
I think there was a question right here that may be a follow-up. So right in the middle, on this side, right? Three rows back, Maeve.
Yeah. Hi, Shirley. Julian Snelder from Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, Hong Kong branch. If I could ask a typically brutal CSBA rail politic question. So if you'll permit me to generalize massively about Asia, there are strong states and weak states. And strong states are technologically advanced, disciplined societies that do things like, you know, invest in anti-ballistic missile defenses. Weak states are, you know, elect populist, emotional leaders who bargain away their interest to China when they get caught up in scandals. And the audience is invited to think of examples. My question is Taiwan a strong state or a weak state? In other words, how hard will Taiwan fight for its identity?
Such a great question, Julian. Thank you. There are many people in the audience who are more of an expert than I am on security issues, but I would say that I've been looking into the defense capability of Taiwan because also many of my students at UVA are very interested in doing research about this on Taiwan. And I think I will refrain from answering your question as to whether Taiwan is a weak state or a strong state, because some countries don't even believe Taiwan is a state. And so we can just refrain from, you know, discussing that as a characterization. It has to become a state first, if at all. But in terms of defense, you know, the question has been always, there are these targets, just like inflation. There are targets like 2% of GDP, how much Taiwan is spending. But I think those are not very relevant questions. The relevant question is, has Taiwan actually been reviewing what its capability is, and how are they able to defend exactly themselves in a conflict? And I think that I think that the DPP is actually doing a big review of this, and it's very good because for years now the focus is on who's going to sell what to us, and whether we have the resources to buy those weapons without really even understanding, do we have the right weapons? Do we have the right kind of weapons? Are we going to be able to defend ourselves for how many days? Is it Navy? Is it Army? I have not seen any good. I've been looking actually for the last month for good analysis, and there's very extreme. This is like the economic policy research I was doing. There's extreme reports, either saying that Taiwan has no defense or saying that Taiwan is doing just fine. And of course, neither of that is true. And I'm hoping for more analysis to come out of this. And the flip side of it is, you're right, in terms of defending its national identity. So this is what I think I have more of an expertise is, do young people feel pride in going to national service? No, there's no sense of pride. It's just to get it over with. And I have a Singaporean student who is about to write a report comparing Singaporeans and Taiwanese. And I said, really, do you have to do that? That is an embarrassing comparison. because it's really different. But, you know, he says he's just fascinated about the decline of the Taiwanese National Service. And, of course, I actually have somebody who used to work for me at Goldman Sachs, who, after working at Goldman Sachs for 10 years, decided to, he's Taiwanese, went to Yale, he decided to return to Taiwan at 38, actually join National Service to experience in full last year. And now he's running his own think tank, writing about this and about the deplorable state of the National Service, because the professionals and the conscript are trained in the same way. They have no capability. They're not interested. Most of them are doing things like watching over museum pieces, or, you know, they have these really interesting way to fulfill national service that you won't believe. And I went to see some of them, and I said, this qualifies as national service, and there's no sense of pride related to it. But I think the issue, of course, is everyone in defense in Taiwan will tell you we need the conscripts. But at the same time, there's no understanding of what those conscripts can actually do in time of conflict. And I think those, both the conscript system as well as the military budget and an overall understanding of what Taiwan can do even in the first few days of conflict, that is sorely needed. Thank you for the question.
As one of the more or less last conscripts into the U.S. Army, don't get me started on national service. Okay, we're going to go here, and then I'll go to the back. The gentleman right here next to John Brandon.
Hello, my name is Ben, and I'm from the Carnegie Endowment. I'm a junior fellow. So my question is, if the U.S. fails to ratify TPP, should Taiwan still consider joining RCEP, a trade pact that is led by China?
I don't think Taiwan is thinking about either or in any case. I think Taiwan should join all of the regional trade agreements they can. The question is whether they can. Taiwan is not up to standards right now, so it is doing everything it can. In the last 2 years of writing the book, I tried to visit the TPP office. Of course, there wasn't such people to visit. In the end, it was difficult to arrange under the Ma administration. But I think things are changing, and TPP is, of course, going to have a difficult time in terms of ratification. And today there is more news, as you have all read, that the U.S. is being told there will be no renegotiation on the TPP. I think that whether the TPP is ratified or not, Taiwan needs to make progress on joining all the agreements. And RCEP right now is not progressing. I don't think China is very focused on it. China is very focused on bilateral agreements. And of course, Taiwan is now in a lull, let's just say. There will be nothing new for a while. But in terms of getting into the TPP, it is paramount in the second round for Taiwan to join. And there are issues like the beef and pork. We've talked about it for so long now. A lot of it is the ability for government to garner support and consensus. It is very important for Taiwan to communicate to the U.S. what it can do to get the support of its people. But Taiwanese government needs to get the Taiwanese behind it and understand it. And certainly, well, first, Americans should get enough support for the TPP. That would be very useful. But other than that, what Taiwan can do is, of course, work on bilateral investment agreements and trade agreements.
The gentleman back in the blue shirt, right in the middle of the back.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Wolfish from Legislative Strategies. I was wondering if, either in the short term or long term, if you think that the government in Beijing would allow for closer cultural ties and or people-to-people exchanges between Hong Kong and Taiwan?
Such a good question. Something, of course, I'm very focused on. And in fact, I'm taking my first group of students from Chinese University of Hong Kong to Taiwan next year. They've been asking me to do it for years, and for years I said, I'm writing a book, I don't have time to do it. Now I have to do it, and the interest is higher than ever before. And in Hong Kong, the primary source of students is really from mainland China. And so graduate schools is basically half mainland Chinese students, and maybe a little bit less than half Hong Kong students. And their common interest is Taiwan. And right now, there's immense opportunity. And maybe I could just ask you in terms of your question, are you saying that because there are a lot of restrictions right now? Well, you know, for the September 4th election in Hong Kong, several people were denied entry into Hong Kong from Taiwan. So this is to be expected. In fact, a lot of people in Taiwan are not able to go to Hong Kong in the past, whether they are in the DPP or in other kinds of organizations that are deemed to be corrupting. And I think that while Beijing may continue to intervene, I think that there will be, there's two ways to look at it. One is, will they encourage it? Naturally not. There's a lot of funding. And Beijing has a, when I talk about soft power in the slides, I mean there's a lot more to talk about. But Beijing has spent considerable resources at cultural exchanges with students from Hong Kong, considerable. You can, if you are a 16-year-old in Hong Kong and you want to go to China and spend a whole summer free, there are many ways to do it. You could do the soccer league. You could do the summer school program for patriotic exchange. There are so many things you can do, and I think that for Taiwanese students, they also tried, but it's not as extensive. Right now, for them to just basically by not giving funds to groups that would do Taiwan to Hong Kong or Hong Kong to Taiwan would basically be means that they are against it because there's so many resources that goes the other way, which is Hong Kong to Beijing. And I think that the current view in Beijing, of course, is that it's very dangerous for Hong Kong students and Taiwan students to get together. But at the same time, the bottom-up forces are, there's very few ways to stop it. So students in Hong Kong regularly go to Taiwan for 2 days. Some go every month. And so I think that as long as there's no border, and Hong Kong, I would defer this to Richard, who's now done so much work on this. I think that Hong Kong, for the time being, does not look like its border will be controlled ostensibly by Beijing. And so as long as the resources are there on an individual level, individuals and groups will be going to Taiwan and will be seeking an alliance. However, I would say that the importance of Hong Kong to Taiwan is symbolic. It's more of an appearance. So by looking at Hong Kong, Taiwanese are not feeling very comfortable, and this only furthers their suspicion as to what may happen if Beijing were to govern Taiwan. But from the other, on the other side, it's totally different. And from my vantage point living in Hong Kong and traveling often to Beijing and Taipei, from Hong Kong's point of view, Taiwan is the new norm. And this is something that is really fascinating. It developed only in the last 3 years, I would say, that Taiwan is the standard, is the gold standard. Whatever we do, if we could just maintain the status quo and keep Beijing away like Taiwan has, then this will be already something quite phenomenal. And you never hear people say this in the past.
The gentleman way in the back, and then I'll come to Nadia.
Ken Marquardt, World Docs. A sort of related question. What is the situation with popular culture in Taiwan? Movies, TV, music? Where does that entertainment come from?
Well, as you probably know, and I just did some literature review about this because we're about to show the Taiwanese all-time favorite Cape Number 7 at UVA. So all of you are welcome. It's open to the public on September 28th. You will find that, of course, the most popular cultural icons are more local, if you will. So Cape Number 7, as well as its other movies by the same director, Wei, is much more focused on a unique local culture of Taiwan. And that is something, of course, in Hong Kong is also on the rise. And I think that there is also, of course, a lot of import coming from China, from Korea, to Taiwan and to places like Hong Kong. But the indigenous, if you will, the local content is something that is quite vibrant. But I'll give you a background story to it. It is quite bottom up, so it's hard to maintain. And part of the reason is a lot of the mass culture products now are mixed. So you would have the main actress is from China, the main actor is from Taiwan, and the producers are from Hong Kong. And this is what makes a successful box office movie and that will sell in all three places. And this kind of activity will be stopped by Beijing and has been several times this year if they deem the content to be too local. And so this is something I am watching with interest. I think that the part I talked about, the most effective strategy for Beijing is to exert soft power. But that is their most frustrating, actually, strategy too. For all that if you invest, and having been an investor in my previous life, I find it so interesting, the investment that Beijing puts in cultural activities, in producing content and soft power is enormous. But the results have been very disappointing. And so why is that? Because culture is something that top-down is very difficult to implement. It needs to have it's a two-way street. You need to have bottom-up students volunteering, doing things, joining and creating content. In fact, I'm writing an article about Taipei for a good friend, Daniel Bell, in Beijing, who's coming out with a book in China. And he says that this book has to have a chapter on Taipei. That's the way it's going to sell. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. His last book about cities sold 5 million copies by Chongqing University Press. And now we're doing volume two. He's doing volume two. And I said, you know, this is fascinating. Young people are fascinated by cities, the culture of city, the spirit of cities. And readers are so fascinated that they have gone online and created websites for his book. on their own initiative. This is China. You know, you have the Tencent groups, and then you have the WeChat groups. You have a website that people created without the author even knowing, just discussing the book and what the spirit of these cities are. So I eagerly volunteer, of course, to write the chapter on Taipei, and I think it will be fascinating. But I think this is the part that Taiwan can actually have an influence in terms of focusing on its culture and what it can offer to Chinese speakers around the world.
I would note, based on a recent personal experience, that most of the people who go to the Palace Museum in Taipei are Chinese tourists. They're going to see their own culture because you can see it better, even more easily in Taipei than you can in China. Nadia Tsao. Actually, I'm surprised that it took this long to get to a Taiwan journalist. So. You guys have been very restrained. It's very unusual.
Finally, but truly, thank you for a great presentation. My question is that we saw tourist interest went out of this Taiwan street to protest the decreasing of mainland tourists. So do you see that many people are talking that China doesn't have to use military power, but they have many tools to utilize to put pressure on Tsai Ing-wen's government? So from your point of view, how successful they will be if they want to do that, use all this economic leverage they have? And to what extent that will hurt themselves because, you know, the cross-strait relations and the economics are so integrated? Thank you.
I think, Nadia, what you meant was hurt itself in terms of political spillover, right? I think economically, there's no doubt. Nothing will hurt China. Taiwan cannot hurt China economically. There's no advanced technology. There's very little that Taiwan is offering that is strategic. So I think that in terms of the materiality, we're really talking about the political spillover. And yes, Beijing knows that pushing too hard has only backfired. So I think that's really what my work has shown. The more it pushes, of course, I don't show this directly, but the backlash is really a lot of times related, for example, like the 2005 anti-secession law led to 500,000 people in Taiwan go on the street and everybody becoming anti-China, at least for several months in the polls. And so China knows better. So after the missile crisis, they also have restrained themselves. But in terms of the tourism, this is a very interesting question because I know the last few days is just full of news about this. As many of you know, there was a tourist bus in Taiwan that crashed and 25 people died. That the driver, it's a very interesting story. The driver is from China and he's been indicted and it was a suicide attempt. Actually, he just wanted to kill himself. He thought there was no justice. He shouldn't have been, he shouldn't have had this run-in with the law. So he drove the bus and drove everybody to death. What is really depressing about this story, and I come from a viewpoint that, of course, I'm very supportive of economic liberalization. I just think that government has to have capacity to deal with those consequences. This is, you know, really my personal conclusion from all of this, is that mainland tourists is a huge part of tourism in never mind Hong Kong, which is 60 to 70%. And I sit on a Hong Kong hospitality board of a hotel chain. So I know this, I look at the number every week. It is seriously hurting Hong Kong businesses, for example, when mainland Chinese decline in number. But that's because the mainland Chinese economy is actually dropping. But on the other hand, the nature of tourism has changed. Korea, Japan, Washington, D.C., for example, is now seeing an all-time high in terms of Chinese tourists. So everybody's relying on it. It's not Taiwan. So first of all, Taiwan needs to accept the fact that this is part of the source of growth for tourism around the world, and that tourists are not the same as government. And I think that a part of what's happening in Taiwan when this accident happened is deplorable in terms of the anti-China sentiment and saying how these tourists, you know, shouldn't be welcome. They are a source of income. And Taiwanese need to deal with it as part of, you know, just being in the global village. But the second thing is, so tourism will decline. And I know this so well because you probably have heard of this fishball protest in Hong Kong. So over Chinese New Year this year, there was a eerily sort of mirroring 228. There was a street hawker who got into trouble with the police, and it led to a big protest in Hong Kong, and young people came out and became very anti-China and joined the Legislative Council election. And long and short is the protest happened right at the hotel that the company I sit on the board actually runs. And overnight, 55 days of FMB was canceled. Can you imagine that for any company? So the story is basically over-reliance on one source of customer is very dangerous. And therefore, all the basically companies are trying to make sure that they diversify, that if you were to take all Chinese tourism, all the hotels in Hong Kong and Taiwan can easily be full all the time. If you take group, which is very low margin, and indiscriminate source of Chinese tourism. So there has to be a way to manage it so that your business can sustain. This is just good business principle. And I think Taiwan just hasn't been looking at it in that way. It has just been wanting to see the aggregate number increase, but it has to manage it so that when there's a problem in China, meaning China can say policy-wise, no more visiting to Taiwan, that Taiwan is able to withstand the hit. And I think right now there's sort of no contingency plan for this. And the second part, though, is the quality of visitors are going up, both in Taiwan and Hong Kong, after the group visitors decline. Group visitors are known to basically force by agents to go buy fake shark fin and whatnot. And so they're of no use to the economy, really, besides to the landlords who sort of own those shops. And so studies in Hong Kong, are far more advanced than in Taiwan in terms of hospitality in showing how tourism does not benefit most people. And so what Taiwan needs to do is find out how to attract tourism, but on top of it, make sure that tourism benefit, those numbers actually trickle down to people who are small, medium businesses, not people selling in the big department store, but selling the fishbowl on the street. And also for students who can be guides, not just guides who are working in a big company. So those are things that have already been extensively studied. But Taiwan doesn't seem to have a strategy, and it's just focusing on the numbers, the decline. But overall, I think right now it hasn't hit a break point yet. You know, there's a big decline in the group numbers, but there's a rise in spending by individuals. And I think the sort of it's still within the band that Taiwan can withstand. But if Taiwan doesn't develop a plan, China will have leverage, and on top of it, China's economic slowdown will have a bigger hit.
Okay, the last question, please.
This is Iris Shaw from the DPP U.S. Mission. If I could contribute to Professor Ling's survey, as a Taiwanese woman, I used to think I will not have any kids. Now I'm having two. So the DPP's paid maternity policy for 3 months works. Very good for your reference. And the other, my actual question is what I'm interested in your thoughts on the DPP administration's bolstering the defense, the indigenous defense industry in Taiwan. For one, this could potentially alleviate the annual arms sales announcement that the U.S. and China have as a pressure point. For a second, maybe it will add to the economic growth.
I appreciate the question. I will say that there are more experts in this than I am, but I support bolstering the plan. But I come back to what I said just now. I think it's more important to know how we use it than to just use more. And resources are very limited. And this is comes. And thank you for the question. It ties back to concluding this talk, which is that the Tsai administration's biggest challenge is ruthlessly prioritizing economic priorities, including security. Security is top in terms of economic agenda because it involves a lot of resources. And like you said, it could change the economy and developing indigenous technology. These are all necessary. They're not even optional. But in terms of prioritization, I think this is where I think it needs to be more transparent. The public also needs to support it to understand that more spending needs to be made. But at the same time, this is the classic gun versus butter issue, right? Are we going to spend more than who is going to be paying for it? Is it the older generation in homes, or is it the maternity leave? This is all dollar, right? And so if you're getting 3 months of maternity leave, I'm really impressed. 3 months of maternity leave, most of Asia, as you know, is only a few weeks. Then somebody is going to give up some entitlement. And entitlement and security, these are all trade-offs that I think that Thai government, as opposed to the Ma administration, can push for more transparency, more consensus building, and this will be, and obviously it's the conclusion, is the what my book is trying to highlight, that Taiwan has a vibrant society with domestic debate about all the issues, and nothing is taboo, and that we need to find a way out of the high-income trap conundrum, which is like the rest of the world, and unique problems like dealing with China.
Thank you for your great questions. Thank you for coming. Please join me in thanking Shirley.